Welcome to Job. This is episode 34. If I may say, big news today is the so-called Heartbleed bug.
That's quite a name.
It's a terrible name, but it just is like the most measured, thoughtful, cautious researcher that I've heard described it as a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 11. That was Bruce Schneier. So a little worried about it. We're going to reach out to our clients today and tell them what to do and, you know, let them know that we're here if they need help because, you know, helps to understand what's going on here.
Right.
So that's big news. The other big news I wanted to mention, since I know this is going out today, is that Condoleezza Rice is joining Dropbox, and that pisses me off.
She's joining the board of directors.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she's going to be a coder.
She's going to start writing code.
That'd be awesome.
So Dropbox is where we store a lot of our files.
Yes.
And your concern is that Condoleezza Rice was...
I'm afraid she's going to turn all of our stuff over to the NSA.
Okay. Well. Yeah.
As you pointed out...
Oh, go ahead.
As you pointed out this morning, we don't have a ton of private, proprietary type stuff. Pretty much everything that we produce is intended for public consumption, so it's kind of an imaginary concern.
Right. But at the same time, we care about the privacy of our clients.
Right.
And
just supporting...
What do you think Dropbox is trying to say with putting her on the board of directors? Do you think that they... probably understood that there would be some of these concerns, yeah?
I would have thought so.
Yeah. Interesting.
Her last board of directorship was Exxon.
Come on.
Before she was in the Bush administration.
Okay.
There is a oil tanker named after her. I just don't like it.
I just want to touch this. Like, let's move on. Like,
okay, fair enough. They're about to go public, that's why.
Okay. So to me, the big news is that Brian Faraday is on the job today.
Yes.
And Brian is a founder and owner of Schoolhouse Electric.
Yes.
And I've been a big fan of their work for a long time. I remember... I don't know, was it a couple years ago, our friend Amy Ruppel did a collaboration with them, a really nice pendant lamp.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when I was first introduced to them, and they were in a very small space, and just walking in and looking at all of their light bulbs and hoping that one day we could have them in our home.
Yeah, they're so pretty.
And so we just moved to a new place, and we've been kind of eyeing a lot of their... pieces, and we got to take the team this week on a tour of the factory, which was just an incredible experience.
Yeah.
To me.
Given by Brian himself.
Ending in the infamous... Oh, it's the...
The fire water
I think of
room.
It as the man cave, but it's the fire water room, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's and which he discusses... what you don't hear is after the discussion, we talked... I think it was after the recording. We talked at length about how when we toured the Washington High School property that Venerable is working on, another good friend of ours, they had those old IBM clocks up.
Right.
And I mentioned those to Brian. I was raving about how cool those clocks were and how sentimental. And he pointed out that we'd been trying to get them to get us one of them, and he pointed out that they would be kind of useless because those clocks are designed to be wired into a central system, how they're timed at a school, at a schoolhouse. But they have licensed and reissued these IBM clocks. Schoolhouse Electric has, and theirs run on a battery, which is far, far more convenient.
Right.
And at the end of the tour... Mr. Brian Faraday took his very own IBM clock made by Schoolhouse Electric off the wall and handed it to us, which was just about the sweetest thing. It was so
sure
cute.
Was.
What a sweet guy. So,
well, let's listen to Brian.
Let's listen to Brian.
Yeah.
All right. Well, hello, Brian.
Hey, Ray.
Thanks for coming down today.
Just got water. It's good to be here.
So let's just dive right in. Are you from Portland or are you?
I am.
You're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And move this slightly closer there. And so you, before Schoolhouse Electric, you were a realtor. Is that what you've done your whole adult working life?
Pretty much. Okay. Yeah, I think it was 15 years.
Okay.
15 to 16 years in the residential real estate.
Okay.
Business over on the east side of Portland.
Okay. And the story, the origin myth, if you will, of Schoolhouse is, and you're going to have to correct me, but that you found inspiration from that and the vintage pieces that you would see to start that. Why don't you tell the story better than me?
Okay. Well, yeah, I was working in residential real estate on the east side. Typically, they're older homes, you know, turn of the century through mid-century homes. But a lot of the Portland was developed in the 20s, you know, before the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so I was, you know, becoming acutely aware of sort of what types of products people were using when they were refurbishing houses, because this was at the start of the kind of DIY movement, you know. So there's a lot of people were buying properties and then restoring them or, mm-hmm. you know, and then reselling them or keeping them or what have you. So I was a part of that entire process. And that's what, day in and day out, that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to see sort of what, you know, how people were doing it well and how people were doing it not so well and everything in between. And what I started to notice was it seemed like there was some opportunities in some of the sort of finishing aspects of the restoration process. And one of them I saw that I was probably the most enamored with was lighting. And so I felt like, you know, I kind of started to do research to find out what happened to a lot of the old fixtures that would have initially been installed in these homes. And the ones that I was the most interested in were the ones that are a little more utilitarian, like what would have been in the kitchens or the bathrooms or the mm-hmm. hallways. It wasn't so much the chandeliers or the real highly decorative pieces, but it was the ones that I thought were the most useful. And some of those fixtures were schoolhouse type fixtures, you know, the old milk glass shades mm-hmm. and brass fixtures. So the ones that were on the marketplace were kind of ubiquitous. You'd see the same ones everywhere. And I thought, and had, you know, from watching a lot of old movies and looking at old books and magazines, looking at Hippo Hardware and other stores, I knew that there were a lot of other shapes and styles out there, but they had seemed like they had kind of vanished. So I tried to figure out, like, why was that?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seemed like those were the most suitable for those properties, and not only homes, but they were pretty flexible. They could go into, you know, boutique commercial locations and you know, stores and coffee shops and, you know, mm-hmm. cafes and things of that nature. And I sort of like that boutique kind of marketplace. And so I found that there were, you know, after the war, the hand-blown glass process had kind of gone away, and they had moved more towards like a press glass process because it was easier. You know, styles had changed, and so as styles had changed, so had the process.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some companies that had hung on to these old molds that the glass was blown into, and one of them was in upstate New York, one of the only ones, I would say, that had a lot of this, these caches of old, you know, glass molds were in, it was in upstate New York. So I went out there, met with them, and looked at them. You know, they had, interestingly enough, they had warehoused and kind of kept all these molds, even though they had really no interest in using them anymore.
Hmm.
It was the same family. It had been in the business since the 1860s.
Okay.
And so they brought down the molds and put them on the floor on pallets in this big warehouse. And I started to kind of look at them and inspect them. And you couldn't open a lot of them because they were rusted shut, but you could kind of feel in the inside to see what the shapes were. And so I knew when I found those molds and when I had negotiated with the family and sort of purchasing them that I had something that was authentic. And it was something that if I could have these molds restored and have the glass blown back in them, that it wasn't as if I was just like knocking off sort of, you know, fixtures from a era long gone,
mm-hmm.
but that I would actually have, you know, the glass would be blown in the original molds from, you know, again, turn of the century through mid-century. So I worked from the glass backwards into the fixture to figure out how I could come up with like a, you know, a nice offering to people that were in that sort of process of mm-hmm. fixing up their homes or their boutique sort of cafes or coffee shops or things of that nature. And it sort of started with that.
And who were your first customers? How did you start out? Did you just was it word of mouth, or did you run ads, or?
You know, we placed some ads in. I want to say it was like, you know, This Old House, American Bungalow.
Okay.
You know, some small kind of mm-hmm. shelter publications. The thing that probably ignited the most was the fact that I think that it was pressworthy because it was an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that it wasn't, there wasn't really a lot of other companies doing the same thing out there.
Yeah.
We also, you know, started kind of the hand-painted process again, where we were painting the glass shades with stripes and things of that nature, which is something that was done kind of during the Depression to kind of cheer people up.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it really, and it was kind of, you know, one customer at a time. You know, we had a catalog. The web wasn't happening at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We had a storefront on MLK. There were like three of us working there at the shop. And, you know, I think it was just something that I didn't even go on the payroll, I think, until like the fourth year of the company being open, because mm-hmm. I knew everything had to kind of go back in to keeping, you know, the doors open.
So was there like a... were you still doing real estate during this time?
I was still doing real estate.
So it was kind of a transition. It wasn't just a...
Yeah, I had two jobs.
Okay.
I remember I bought this white Ford Ranger truck with a canopy, because I had to kind of change like my own, like, you know, personal style, and because I needed really a truck to haul stuff around and parts around and stuff. And I drove home. My mom, my wife looked at me and she's like, "Oh my God, I married the cable man," you know. But that's what it took.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'd meet my customers at the houses. I'd show them, as opposed to driving them in my own car, because I had a two seat pickup truck, you know. And
yeah, I remember that MLK location. That was that worked out really well. I mean, it was a nice showroom. Because the character of the building fit the what you were showing and selling there, I think.
It did. It was a nice, you know, sort of Victorian Italianate building. It had real high ceilings, and
yeah,
it was a nice space.
You know, my I think when I had an epiphany about that sort of stuff, I mean, obviously the shop is a great place to see that stuff, but we mentioned Venerable earlier, and we worked with them to make a website for the Washington High school building that they're remodeling, and so they're taking everything out. So we did a tour of the building to sort of look around, and I was just freaking out at, like, they had those old IBM clocks and like the great old light fixtures and stuff that hadn't been touched in many, many, many decades. Mm-hmm. You know, the little, you know, they had like little intercoms with little things you pick up and talk. And I was just like, how can we get this stuff? I still haven't heard, and I think they're avoiding us, about getting some of that old stuff. But I know you saw some stuff like that too. Like, how is it that you came about selling what appears to be a vintage IBM clock from my childhood? Like, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. You know, because I think I've shared that with you, because I love the old school clocks.
So yeah.
Just like, or, you know, like institutional clocks or just indicator clocks. And a lot of those were, you know, master and slave type systems. And so, you know, to take those out of that school would render them sort of useless, because it was a whole system.
Right.
But our graphic design firm that we were working with on our sort of lifestyle launch, when we went from a lighting company to a, you know, a lifestyle brand,
mm-hmm.
VSA Partners, they were out of Chicago, and they worked with IBM, and it was their 100-year anniversary. So I was able to kind of get a meeting with IBM to talk about the idea of getting a licensing agreement with them to actually, you know, to have an American-made 1960s IBM indicator clock. And they're really excited about it. So we still have that agreement with them, and we're still selling a lot of IBM clocks. And
that's great.
Yeah, we're in the process of working with GE on one as well right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So it's kind of becoming this thing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's great.
So I've heard that you make most of your stuff in Portland. Is that still true?
That's right.
Okay. Is it actually by where the showroom is now?
Yeah, we do all of our finishing and assembly in the showroom.
Okay.
There on Nicolai.
Hand painting and everything.
Yep.
Oh. Does it make people happier, the stripe? Do you still do the stripe?
We still do the stripe. So the stripes. So we do a lot of hand painting on fixtures at the Nicolai building, but the striping is done actually in West Virginia, where our glass is blown.
Oh, okay.
It's literally like a room full of like grandmas that sort of have these little spinning wheels, and they're just sitting there holding the paintbrush to the glass and
wow,
one by one. I think it does. I mean, right now we have the stripes we have on our fixtures weren't really anything that you'd see, you know, back in the 1920s, but they're sort of, you know, stripes are really in right now, and so, you know, blue stripes or gray stripes or black stripes on some of our fixtures, I think they do make people happy. And we have just gone through this recession, so I think there's something about patterns and stripes and plaids and things of that nature that are nice as opposed to just solid colors or just, you know, white. So,
Does your inspiration purely come from finding old vintage stuff, or are you to the point where now you kind of just are starting to come up with completely unique, original, blue sky concepts and products?
I mean, I think a lot of the products come from somewhere, as opposed to just, you know, like they're born out of other ideas. Like fashion is a big inspiration to me and to my co-creative director, Sarah Culbertson, that I work with at Schoolhouse, and our team. You know, you'd be surprised. It just comes from nature. I mean, there's just a lot of different things that are inspiring to us. The one thing that's been sort of at the root of how we develop product, though, is this idea of like usefulness. You know, so we don't really necessarily like to develop things are products that are just really pretty that you just like admire, you know, on a shelf or something. They're things that we think that people can use that make their daily lives more useful, mm-hmm. particularly in the world of sort of consumerism that we're in now, where everything is so disposable. Mm-hmm. You know, how we buy these things for our home or for our lives from, you know, big box stores or, you know, the IKEA, the Target, all those things. And I'm, you know, our family is as guilty of that as anybody. I mean, I have three kids, and it's, you know, we can only afford so many things that are American made or handmade. Yet, I guess our marketplace kind of lies in that area where people, you know, they want to buy something that's more lasting, that's going to last longer, that they're going to appreciate more than those sort of disposable things. I mean, I kind of look at it like in my life, like I have this, if I have two circles and one of them is sort of reality and one of them is fantasy, there's an intersection between those two things. So like when I think about how I live my life or when I think about my house, mm-hmm. I don't think about it like a museum or a place that's just beautiful that, you know, that people would walk into and go, oh, wow, look at this. You know, I think about it more. There might be a little bit of that, like aspirational thing, but mm-hmm. a lot of it is because I have a family and because we use every square inch of our house is sort of, you know, where are those two intersecting circles? You know, where can it like look really cool, but also be useful and functional and not ostentatious, but sort of, you know, practical, you know, but how can the things that are practical in the house also kind of make me smile, you know, mm-hmm. and that could be from like, utensils that help me brush up the bark dust from when I'm building the fire to the log carrier to, you know, anything. It can be sort of, you know, things that are kind of, you know, domestic utility items or, you know, art or anything. So mm-hmm. we also really have a strong belief in reusing, you know, things. And so that's another sort of charter at our company. We're not so much like when you look at Restoration Hardware and you see their, you know, their showrooms, which they now call galleries, I think it's, to me, it would be difficult to look at that environment and think, well, how do I mix my own, how do I kind of take my own things and mix in with theirs? It's like, it's almost like it's kind of a, I don't know, it's like you have to kind of buy that entire look and kind of buy into that entire look. What we're saying is we think people should bring their own relics and their own, you know, the couch that's been in the family a long time or the chair or the armoire or whatever it is and kind of mix it in with things. And mm-hmm. to me, that's more of a, it's it. To me, it's more a little more interesting to look at your life that way. To sort of, I like the patina from things from the past, you know, so I'm not looking for everything to be brand new or all shiny and, mm-hmm. you know, just had purchased this look. It's kind of like things that we drag along with us or that we get or we keep in our families for years mm-hmm. and years. So it's kind of finding that balance, I think, is important. So for us, it's more about like, are there little things you can get from us that are going to help you in your own, you know, how you put together your own environment?
Well, I think for me, maybe nothing is more emblematic of that than some of the light bulbs that you sell. I mean, because I have taken a pretty ordinary looking fixture and put one of those light bulbs in there, and suddenly, you know, that fixture just seems like it has a 100-year rich history, which frankly it probably does. It's a very beaten up fixture.
Right.
But, you know, I think perhaps those products came along at just the right time where, like, every light bulb in my home probably a few years ago was fluorescent because, of course, that's good for the earth and everything. But there's definitely something missing. And when you can bring back in something that's, you know, an incandescent light that, is that the right word? Yeah. With, you know, with elaborate filaments that you can look at, it's like, I can't believe someone actually makes this, you know? Like, I have furniture that's really old, but it's crazy that I can go out and buy a light bulb that actually works with that.
And those, you know, those light bulbs you're going to be able to use for a long time because they're basically called novelty bulbs now. And with everything, you know, the incandescent light bulbs are going to be going away. Mm-hmm. And now the LED is sort of coming in to be, I think, the major sort of consumer bulb.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're going to see as much of the fluorescent type stuff. I think that's going to kind of go away. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting transition. So I'm glad that we're still able to use the Edison bulbs and the Marconi bulbs mm-hmm. because they're atmospheric. They're kind of like, you know, electric candles, if you will. Mm-hmm. And they really are nice.
I mean, provided one didn't light their whole home with it, it's a nice, you know, accent. I mean, is it something where that's actually been a challenge for your business that people are using so much fluorescent or LED lighting, that kind of thing?
I mean, you know, since our lights aren't necessarily, I mean, we have like some of the schoolhouse shades are really, you know, the white globes. I mean, those are great task lighting. Mm. You know, they distribute light very evenly. But when you get into fixtures where it's clear glass and you want to have an Edison or Marconi bulb or something like that, I mean, those are more, I think people are using those sort of more sporadically. And there's certain places in the room. It's where maybe you're not going to do homework under that light bulb
right. Necessarily,
but it's going to set the mood for a nice dinner party or for kind of visiting by the fire or, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think there's a balance between both.
Do you, when you're working on, say you're developing a product or you're working out a new design, do you reach a point where you're like, this isn't something we can sell. This is just a dead end. Is there a point at which you know, like, are you thinking about how something's going to be manufactured from day one? Is that part of your thought process?
Yeah, it really is. And we're, you know, it's so imagine sort of like a starting line with, you know, 12 toy cars at the beginning. I'm not the cars of the product, but they stand for a product. And you're kind of moving all those things ahead as far as you can in terms of, you know, who are the vendors we're going to work with on this part? Like, what part of the process are we going to be involved with? Are these parts we can even get? You know, are we making enough of them to where it's even going to be? Mm. We can find a marketplace for us. That's what's tough about the size of our company is, you know, we're not buying containers really full of anything. Mm-hmm. And we're not a cash and carry store either. So we're, you know, a lot of these things we're developing in house and we're either adding value to the process or we're actually, you know, having parts made for a certain product and then finishing that thing in house. Now there are a lot of other products that we just buy, like bedding is something that we have made elsewhere. But it's, a lot of it is like, you know, can we make it? Can we make it here? Is it going to be competitive? Is there a marketplace for it? But yet there are a lot of things that we do that a lot of other retailers wouldn't do because they would say, well, this makes no sense because you're only going to sell, you know, you're going to run out of capacity with the company you're buying that from. They can only make 50 of those blankets a year. And if we can only sell 50 blankets, why would you even do it? And for us, it's like, well, the only reason we do it is because we love the blanket. And those 50 people that get those are going to probably come back and see what else we have later. So it's, we're sort of set up for the small batch manufacturers, you know, which that's what we are. So,
mm-hmm. So how long have you been in your current location in Portland where you've had retail in there?
We've had retail in there since 2012.
Okay. And were the flowers and the coffee, were those in there from day one?
I think they came in like maybe 90 days after we opened.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was the inspiration for that?
You know, I mean, we had this beautiful building that was kind of a little bit off the beaten path, you know, sort of on the edge of Northwest Portland. It's right at the start of the you know, what's considered heavy industrial sort of zoning. And we thought if we're going to get people to come to our location, we want there to be a certain experience for the customer, you know, and part of that. So, you know, bringing in Ristretto Roasters, who I've known for a long time, and I really respect their craft and how they approach what they do. You know, the agreement was, if they could help with the build out of that space, and I would help with it as well, that I wouldn't charge them rent for that space. Same thing with Anamara Flowers. You know, we have about a 7,500 square foot space there, and so I thought, you know, if Ristretto Roasters has 300 square feet, I mean, what am I really going to benefit from getting, mm-hmm. you know, what, $20 a square foot for 300 square feet, like $600, you know, a month? It's like, what I want is happy customers, people that come in who can hang out, whether they're shopping in the store or not. I really want it to be sort of a destination. And I really, to me, into the company, what's really important is sort of the experience that our customers have. And by having fresh flowers and coffee, I think it just makes it more of a special experience to come to the store and hang out there for a little bit. It's more enjoyable, I think.
Yeah. So you have a shop in New York.
We do.
And how has it been received?
It's been great. It's been there for 9 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so, I had no idea. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You don't do any like manufacturing there?
No.
It's
just a storefront.
Okay.
Yeah. So we have, recently when we went from lighting to lifestyle, we had to really change that showroom out because it really was more of a showroom before. And now it's right now it sort of feels more like a mercantile experience. So it's because we have no storage space, there's no back room, we've had to get as much stock into that space as we can. I mean, a lot of things are shipped from Portland, you know, direct to consumer, but for those that like to walk in and buy something from the store, we have it set up to where you can actually, there's quite a bit of product actually you can buy in the store.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Interesting. When I saw you at TEDx last year, which was a great talk, you Thanks. Talked about your fire and water room.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give our listeners a brief explanation of what that is and how that came about for you?
Well, when we were building out the offices, the studios, and the retail, production facilities, the whole thing at that building, there was this little room off the dock that was the old shipping foreman's office, and knowing just myself and kind of how I work in a studio environment, I really like to have like a place. I always really wanted a place that I could go where I wouldn't be interrupted. I could have meetings with people where there's not people walking up to my door and looking in and kind of like, you know, give me that signal, like, do you have a minute or whatever. I really wanted a space where I could have more meaningful sort of connections and discussions with people. At the same time, I really wanted to have a space that that I didn't use, you know, my iPhone or my iPad, or I didn't have like, you know, any sort of hard line to my, you know, the whole world of like the internet and and sort of smartphones and things of that nature. Because I really, I don't know about you, but my life is so consumed with that world and meetings and, you know, all that stuff that I like to have a space where it's like, that's off limits, you know, where you just, that's not what I do in that room.
Mm-hmm.
So I built myself this, what I call sort of a fort, a place that I can go. I have a wood stove in there. I have sparkling water and a sofa and a few chairs. I have an old AM/FM radio, and I have a lot of meetings in that room. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them are work-related and some of them aren't. But it's nice to kind of be in that building, but yet have this space where I can get away from things. And nobody comes and knocks on that door. There's a rule that, you know, you can't come and find me in that space. And mm-hmm. I just, it's nice because it sort of enables me, I think, to be, you know, more present when I'm in the meetings in other parts of the building, but just by having that space where it's like, you know.
How long have you had that space now?
I've had that space for almost 2 years now.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was done at the same time that we were building out the store.
Okay. Do you feel like it's changed you, your personality or your mood at work to have that there?
I think it has. You know, it's like we're in the process of designing and building a beach house. And we had a beach house before. I've always had a place to get away to. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's not always even that I go to that place, but knowing that I can go to that place also just sort of kind of helps me and with my bandwidth issues. Because that's kind of my problem is that I really, as this company has grown and we have more employees and there's more happening and there's more demands of me, I find that I have to be really careful with how I fill up my bandwidth, you know, because I'm only as effective as sort of my own resources, you know. Mm-hmm. And so by having that room, I feel like it gives me a little flexibility with my bandwidth, with people, with process, with systems, with all those things that, you know, that I'm forced to work on that maybe you don't want to spend as much time on. I mean, the thing that I enjoy doing the most is working on, you know, developing product, you know, like marketing sort of ideas, and thinking about the customer. You know, that's sort of those are the areas that I like to spend most of my time in. But with a growing company, there's personnel, there's mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. there's all the finance, the systems, the processes, all these other needs, and I don't know. It helps me with balance in my life, I guess. But it has changed me in some ways. Yes.
Is it a completely serendipitous or just a random thing that you would go in there, or is there like, do you find yourself tending to go in there in the afternoons or a certain time of day where you just sort of retreat into your fort?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. It's depends on what kind of meetings I have, because during the winter time I have to have a fire in that room, or otherwise it's too cold to even be in there.
Right.
So I have to give some thought to it. So if I know I'm going to have a couple meetings in that room, I have to go in the morning and get the fire going.
Okay.
But I also like that kind of preparation as well.
Right. That's interesting. That's really interesting. It kind of, and I was wondering, I read a little bit about that room preparation for this conversation, and I heard more than once about you listening to KMHD specifically.
Yeah.
Is it that the radio won't tune to other stations, or that there's no other suitable station in Portland for that room? Or are you actually a jazz fan?
You know, I'm not like a, I don't have a ton of like, I have a record player in my regular office, mm-hmm. And I do have some jazz albums. I wouldn't say I've ever been like a huge jazz fan. There's something about, and this is an old like 1970s, it's actually an 8-track player that happens to have an AM/FM radio with it. But there's something about the sound that comes out of that with that jazz. And the thing I love about KMHD is I don't think I've ever heard the same song twice. And it's different forms of jazz. And
oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So it's like I don't know. It's almost like, I don't know. I feel like there's something that's unfamiliar about it that I love, mm-hmm. you know. And even though it's becoming this familiar, you know. I've had it on KGON in there a couple times, and it was okay, but it just didn't seem like, you know, like having like Led Zeppelin or something. I don't know, it just wasn't that relaxing. And so right. I like that it's kind of a bad. I mean, I know sometimes I'll be meeting with someone in that room, and I'll have it on KMHD, and I'll kind of sense that it maybe is a little bit too loud for the person that I'm meeting with, and I'll maybe turn it down a little bit. But for myself, I almost like the. Have like that those two things going at the same time. It does something to my. It's like when I run, I like listening to music, mm-hmm. and then I can think and have the music at the same time, and mm-hmm. I feel like I can do both those things. So it's, I don't know. It's maybe the same thing in that room. It's relaxing.
This is probably unrelated, but well, it is because it's not about me. But we my wife and I often go to this. It's a lighthouse that's also a bed and breakfast, kind of between Yahats and Florence on the coast. And all of the rooms have these old, old, old radios, you know, the sort of almost pyramid-shaped, rounded, there's probably a name for that shape. They look like little cathedrals. Mm-hmm. They're wonderful, but of course you can't really get radio there. There's really nothing to listen to. For the longest time, I had this little adapter for my iPod, so I could get internet there, strangely enough, I could get my iTunes radio to play through there, where I would have like old jazz, and then it would transmit that through a little FM transmitter to the radio, and then I would just hide it in a drawer because I liked being in this old room where everything was so vintage around me. I just liked the fact that radio could actually play period music. Mm-hmm. And I like to imagine that, like, the light keepers, although I'm sure they didn't get radio either, but that they would be listening to that. That wasn't a question. That was just me ranting about.
But, you know, but I think that's it's interesting you say that, because we're in this world where it's like everything is at our fingertips. I mean, we can see who Jimmy Fallon was, you know, singing or dancing with last night. You know what I mean? The history of rap or whatever, right? Or anything we want. It's right there. Yet the thing that sometimes it sounds like you desire, and I do too, is sort of that thing that's always kind of going, you know, that's that we don't really pick. It's just like they're serving you something else. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I get fed by that as much. I think a lot more than just me sort of, you know, tapping into sort of in the Pandora of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I don't know. I there's something that's and maybe it's because that's what they used to have, and it's like things are so selective now. I don't know. It's with this on-demand world that we live in. It's nice to take a break from that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where did the name Fire and Water come from? Random question.
You know, it was like the basic elements. You know, because mm-hmm. I have the wood stove and I have this old GE refrigerator full of sparkling water. So it's just it's like
okay.
Really, there wasn't a ton of thought into it, and I made this little logo, this FW logo that I like. people are like, "What does that? What does that mean?" Or what?
Do you prefer a pen or a pencil?
Pencil.
Okay. Mechanical or
no? Just an old, like, just a number two school, yellow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you seen this book?
No, I haven't.
This is my gift to you.
Oh, thank you. Okay. No, I never have.
You'll love it.
How to sharpen pencils.
Absolutely love that book.
You know, funny thing is I do collect pencil sharpeners.
That does not surprise me in the least, but yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
Pleasure talking to you.